This is The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we're speaking with Spencer P. Eccles, Managing Director of the Cynosure Group and former Executive Director of the Governor's Office of Economic Development, also known as GOED, for the state of Utah. Few families have done more to make Utah a better place to live, a better place to work, and a better place to play than the Eccles. Through their various foundations, the lives of thousands of families here in Utah and nationwide have been meaningfully touched. Spencer, it's an honor to have you as a guest. Thank you for joining us today on The Bottom Line.
Doug, thanks for having me.
So I shared with you in the green room before the interview, I want to start, your family has such a rich history, and if it's okay with you, I want to start kind of talking about how the Eccles ended up in Utah. I know your great-grandfather, he and his family, when he was a young boy, a teenager, I guess, immigrated here from Scotland. What drove his family here? Was it economic opportunity? Was it religious freedom? Or what was the driver?
I think it was a number of things, but I think really the opportunity came about because they, like many of the early pioneers, so to speak, they were influenced by the LDS Church. They converted to the church. And While they were in Scotland. So David Eccles was... his father was a blind woodworker, in essence, and the LDS missionaries had come to their home, and they converted to the Mormon faith. And as a result of that, there was the Perpetual Immigration Fund, which enabled an indigent woodworker and his family, with nothing but the shirts on their back and living in the slums of Scotland, it enabled them to get on a ship and make it over here because they didn't have enough money to do that. And then, of course, once they were here and were somewhat established and able to pay money back into that, thus the name Perpetual, back into that fund, then that helped bring other settlers over. And so that's really how it started. And David came over when he was age 14 in 1863.
Okay. And so his parents came first and then later David came?
No, the whole family came. But actually, an interesting story around that was they were over here. They had come across on the ship the Cynosure, which is also the namesake of our company, but it also means the North Star. And David and a friend and his brother, his older brother, got off the train to get some food on the platform, I guess, and the train started pulling away. And they ran after it, and the platform master said, "Oh, don't worry, it's just changing tracks." And the train kept going, and it left him there in the station. And you can imagine you're age 14 in a foreign country, really no money, what do you do now? And they started working, and the oldest brother ended up going back to Scotland, and David and his friend were able to hook a ride somehow on a train, earned enough money to get back on, and they were able to regroup together. But, you know, in an age where we live and are so dependent upon a cell phone and whatnot, you had none of that. So I'm sure his parents were having a complete fit.
Absolutely. And, you know, a trip like that is filled with a lot of challenges. And even when you arrive, the challenges are not over. They eventually settled in the Ogden area. Uh-huh. And struggled for a while to make ends meet. What did David's father do for work when he first arrived?
Well, so as I mentioned, David's father was blind, virtually blind. And he would work on a wooden lathe to make things like bowls, and he would also make utensils, wooden utensils. And at age 8, David was selling those things on the streets of Scotland. And so they were all very independent, but he was very independent, and that's what they did to make a living. But, you know, somehow they ended up with a couple of oxen up in the valley in Eden, and one died as they were coming into winter. And determined not to lose that second ox, they would bring it in each day and each night into their wooden home. And
sure,
you can imagine
their livelihood depended on that.
Yeah,
ox.
Yeah. And you can imagine they're not probably the cleanest animals. And it was just something they were determined not to lose that animal. Well, of course, they were feeding it on dry straw and anything else they could help it get to, and it would forage out and digging through the snow. When summer came or when spring came and all the grass started coming up, anybody that's worked with animals, with livestock or cattle, know that the grass that comes up, you know, it's fairly rich, especially if an animal's been on dry feed all winter. Well, that ox went out and started eating and gorging itself ultimately on that hot grass and fell over, bloated up, fell over and died.
Oh, no.
Right in front of them. So after all that sacrifice, that's what they ended up with. And they had a number of setbacks and disappointments like that, like all of our ancestors did in the early days of society in America. And I think that's what is forged here in America. You know, that's that entrepreneurial spirit, that independence, that ability to meet disappointment and overcome it and ultimately hopefully succeed. And I think that's really part of our heritage and our history, and I think that we all share in that in many different ways if all we do is look back and see who came before us.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's amazing. Here we are 4 generations, 5 generations past those types of events, and you still see that core ethic, that tenacity in the entrepreneurial ecosystem here in Utah. I would argue, I moved here from the Bay Area, which is another entrepreneurial hub. But I would argue the Bay Area has nothing on Utah entrepreneurs when it comes to tenacity, stick-to-itiveness, and just a willingness to do what it takes to ultimately see the company succeed. We've had entrepreneur after entrepreneur tell those stories of, you know, 10, 12 years working hard until they, quote-unquote, have that overnight success. And it's a wonderful trait for the people of Utah.
Yeah. Well, and if you're an adopted son or daughter of Utah, you don't have that per se in your heritage. I think that Utah brings the best out of people in terms of that culture. We've seen it over and over again. When I was working in the governor's office on the economic development side, companies that would come here, companies that did great things, well, they would come here and they would do even better things in terms of volunteerism and getting involved in the community.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Spencer P. Eccles, Managing Director of the Cynosure Group and former Executive Director of the Governor's Office of Economic Development for the state of Utah. So let's stay with David. He came over as a teenager, very tough settling. Ultimately, I did a little research I do for all of our guests. He studied and became what's known as a figurer. And I have to tell you, as much research as I did, it's such a common term that I wasn't able to understand or learn. I can guess, but I'm not sure. What does a figurer do?
Well, I think that in David's case, is he could see opportunity. And he had very little education in terms of formal education. He used to keep in his businesses in the early days of some of the smaller business, he used to keep the numbers on pieces of wood. You know, you'd do the calculation and that piece of scrap wood would ultimately be lost or whatever, but that's how he kind of kept things. But in an early age, he and his family ended up in the Northwest Territories, you know, up in the Oregon area and whatnot, and he saw the potential of all the timber there, and that's really where he started the majority of what he was doing. And ultimately came back to Utah, but, you know, committed that he was going to go back there, and that's where he really could put all of his hard work forward. And as a result of that hard work, you benefit to the degree that you work hard.
Yeah.
Right? And so as far as being a figurer, I think that he just is a guy who could see things, and of the plus 50 companies that he was involved with or started, he was able to find really great people that had integrity, that were honest. He was fair with them, they were fair with him, and they all worked hard. And I think that was part of the secret of his success, is his ability not only to see opportunity but to see potential in people and find good partners.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier, and we're going to get to it, your work at the Governor's Office of Economic Development. I'll start calling it GOED just to keep it short. But in your great-grandfather's day, the growth industry of the day back then was the railroad industry. You mentioned the resources in the Northwest, the timber. Timber is just trees unless somebody needs it.
Right.
And the folks that needed it was the railroads. And your father was able to parlay really the railroads being built and that new industry taking off right when he was beginning his adult life. you know, people forget, you know, there's many families that have gotten their first start helping out the railroads. There's also many families that lost a lot of money dealing with the railroads. They were very powerful. They were very shrewd. What do you think it was about your great-grandfather and his family that allowed him and his businesses to thrive working with the railroads?
Well, first of all, he had an attention to detail, and he also had an attention to expecting the same out of other people as he expected out of himself. And so where he worked hard, he expected others to do the same, and that combination allowed him, or enabled him, I should say, to keep an eye on things. And of course, then he had good partners. And so a lot of times, some of those railroads, some of the, or at least the spurs, were created out of necessity, right? They would be out in the fields, and they would be cutting trees down, and they would have these mobile places to handle all the lumber that they were taking. But then they had to, how did you get it from there the longer distances? Either you used the rivers to get it down to the mills, or you had your mobile mills, and then you'd have to put it onto a spur. And so he was involved with a lot of railroads himself, actually building them, owning them, Sumter Valley Railroad in Baker, Oregon, and others. And so that's one area. And then others were, like, for example, Utah Construction, and was ultimately started by the Wattis brothers, and they had some financial difficulties. David got involved partnering with them, and after his death at age 62, Mariner Eccles really kind of took over the family's assets and the management of it, and Mariner, my great uncle, was 22 at the time. He kept everything together, and he really drove things. And ultimately, Utah Construction became Utah International, which built and led out on the Hoover Dam, became the largest shipping and mining company in the world, and sold in 1979. And that's all starting from little Utah, and from people like David and the Wattis brothers, and then being carried on by, you know, family members with like Mariner and Littlefield and others like that.
And it's, you know, it's amazing the power of these values that, mm-hmm. that Utah teaches us all. Your great-grandfather that saved $15,000 over, you know, a fairly substantial period of time. You know, you go back to 1860 and you think, wow, that must be millions. It's actually not. I did the math. It's $220,000 in today's dollars. So it's a significant sum. It's a meaningful sum. He probably really was a great, not only a great business person, but a great saver, because mm-hmm. he had to save that. And he was able to parlay that first $15,000, then his mills and everything. He was able to save $50,000. And that was really the base for all of this. Mm-hmm. It just strikes me that, you know, he had little successes along the way and built on those, much the same way successful entrepreneurs, successful business people do today.
Yeah, well, I think it points out a really important principle. And the principle is twofold. One, we mentioned earlier the company, or the companies that David and then Mariner were involved with, and the rest of the Eccles family. And it takes a long time to build a great company. In this day and age, where we have these almost immediate ramps to success, whether it's a Facebook or an Uber or other companies like that are tech-related type companies, these companies that David was involved with were capital-intensive. They were building the American West, and there were others like it, obviously. But it really comes down to the fact that it takes a long time, and sometimes generations, to build a great company.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest today is Spencer P. Eccles, the managing director of the Cynosure Group and the former executive director of the Governor's Office of Economic Development, GOED, for the state of Utah. You mentioned earlier your great uncle, Mariner Stoddard Eccles. He and another one of your great uncles, his brother, George Eccles, at your great grandfather's passing, took over many of the business entities and aggregated together several of the banks to create what became known as First Security Corporation. The year was 1928 when they did all that. It seems like awful timing to be aggregating and building a banking empire. And the Great Depression started in 1929, lasted a long time. How did they navigate that?
Just hard work, I think, tenacity, and just a sense of never giving up. And, you know, even some of these companies that we see today that just kind of seem like they explode, sometimes they've been in business for 10 years and they've just been working and trying to find the right recipe. It's hard work. It's tenacity. It's never quitting. And in the case of Mariner, in his book, Beckoning Frontiers, he references the time period, you know, coming into the Great Depression. And there's a chapter titled The Pit. And he talks about that in the sense that he had been raised in a family, a Scottish family. And stereotypically, a Scottish family is very frugal. They are great savers. You mentioned David was a great saver. He was. And he passed that along to his children. He passed along the whole idea of hard work. But when the Depression hit and banks were failing.
I mean, almost every bank in the country failed. There were over 10,000 banks that failed during the Great Depression.
And I don't think we really had perspective on that, at least modern day people like ourselves that didn't live through the Depression.
Goodness. Yeah. Thank goodness we don't have
Thank goodness we don't. But we do have some insight into that with the Great Recession we've just been through, where we had a complete seizure in the credit markets. And the ability to do business ceased because you had no ability to access capital because nobody knew who was holding all the risk. And in Mariner's case, he titled the chapter The Pit, and he talked about how he felt like he woke up one morning in a pit with no ability or no means to scale the sides of this pit. It was just smooth-sided in the way he kind of envisions it and describes it. And he talks about how he had to have this enormous paradigm shift from what David had espoused, which is, you know, you just work hard. And every man is his own person, his own master. And the harder you work, the better results you'll have. Well, it was a time period when that wasn't the case. Mariner had to go against the flow where everybody thought this will pass. This is just a normal part of markets. This is just a cycle, and it will restart itself. And Mariner was convinced that was not the case. And that was a situation where he felt like the government has to step in, and it has to prime the pump here, because you had this death spiral of people losing their jobs. So consumerism, any ability to buy something, was being eliminated, and supply was having to cut back because there was no demand, which was causing the unemployment, and it just became this negative feedback circle. And so Mariner had to part with what he believed in and what people thought was the proper paradigm.
And it was very controversial.
Very controversial at the time. And so he was giving a number of speeches, and that's when FDR, President Roosevelt, saw him in a way where he felt like he might be able to help, and that's when he got involved with the Fed. But it had a lot to do with this paradigm shift. The other side of that, however, is Mariner espoused that in some cases the government has to step in to stimulate the economy. And the other side of that, though, is in good times you have to pay down the debt, and that's the part where I think the country has not done
a
good job. No, it's not as much fun, and you have to be willing to step forward and do that. And if you're not going to be, then you're going to find yourself in a difficult situation. I think that's where we're headed right now.
Yeah. Well, we're not a political show, so we won't get too deep into that. But I think that's good advice for all of us. It's the way our families have to live, and ultimately, you've got to pay down your debts. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that your great uncle, Mariner, got involved in the Fed. That's an understatement. He became chairman of the Federal Reserve and served for 16 years. I mean, mm-hmm. that's a very long period of time. And to this day, the building that the Federal Reserve is housed at, is named the Eccles Building in honor of your great uncle. So your family's rightfully proud of what he did and how he helped the country. And I think we as Utah should be proud of a fellow Utahan making as big of a impact on the country at an important time. And in fact, many people have heard of John Maynard Keynes. Mm-hmm. There's a whole study of economics known as Keynesian economics. Keynes was a British economist. Your great uncle actually published several books that talk about the core theories that Keynes is famous for. But your great uncle's book actually came out before Keynesian's research was published. So in many ways, Keynesian demand side stimulus, which is what we were talking about earlier, really came here from Utah and from your family. It's pretty amazing.
Well, I think it's amazing, but what I think about when I think about a Mariner Eccles or some of the other great figures that we've had that have come out of this state, Pixar Films, for example, or Ed Catmull, we forget about the incredible things that have come from Utah, and we should be proud of that as a state and celebrate that. And I think each person, if they take a look back at their own heritage, each person has heroes like that in their own past, and that's something that we should pay more attention to as individuals, and not only that, but celebrate it and incorporate those great values of our ancestors into our lives.
Absolutely. You mentioned Catmull and Pixar. Most people think of Pixar as a technology company, and they certainly are. They do the animated films, wildly successful, bought by Disney. And I would argue, and I think Catmull would agree, I've read his book, Creative. I forget the it's Creative. Help me out. Have you read his book?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the name. It just escaped me.
It's an awesome book, and what I did not expect is it's a management book. Mm-hmm. It's a book on leadership and how to lead an organization, and I would argue that that was probably Catmull's biggest contribution to Pixar is mm-hmm. how do you build a team, and how do you build a team where you can give feedback and criticism in a way that you don't kill the creative process, which is very difficult to do. So you're absolutely right. Utah has many successful folks like this and families. We're getting to I want to stick a little bit longer on your story. Your great uncles, George and Mariner, your grandfather is Spencer Stoddard Eccles.
That's correct.
And there's not a whole – I wasn't able to find a whole lot on your grandfather. What? Tell me about your grandfather.
So he passed away before I was born, but he was part of the family of the nine kids. And each of the sons and daughters kind of had responsibility for different things from what was passed along after David passed away. And he was involved a lot on some of the agricultural equipment companies. And, you know, I think the most important thing I can say about him is that he raised my father and my aunt, and he and my grandmother were, you know, for me, they're a couple of my heroes. And my dad has this just deep streak of loyalty and commitment and hard work. And I think that was passed along to him through his mom and through his dad, my grandfather.
Well, let's talk about your dad. And now we're getting into the era of family history that you've lived through and have a lot of experiences with. Your father, Spencer Fox Eccles, ended up being chairman of the board and CEO of First Security Corporation mid-1980s until it was sold in 2002. To Wells Fargo. That must have been really hard for your father to make the decision to sell the business. I mean, at some price, and it was a nice price back then. And yeah, how do you think your father, and I'm sure you guys have chatted about it, decided, you know what, this is the right time to sell, sold to Wells Fargo?
Right. Well, at the time, when you think about Utah. And Utah was, Salt Lake City, Utah, was and is a financial capital of the Intermountain West. in many regards, and First Security was a component of that. And I mentioned earlier my father's just deep sense of loyalty, and also a deep and strong commitment to the state of Utah. And he really believed in the importance of having a regional or even a super regional bank headquartered here in the state and in this region. It makes a big difference. And having now worked nearly 5 years in GOED, I can see the importance of having a strong banking presence in an area. Having headquarters companies in your city, in your state, make a big difference locally. They give back, they're involved, especially a bank where they're involved with every aspect of our lives, whether it's our credit card, our checking account, our savings account, our line of credit, our small business loan, our mortgage. They're involved in every aspect of our life. And so they have a reason to be committed to building the economy, because that's good for business, but it's also good for the state. And when I think about my father and the timing of the transition and the merger of First Security with Wells, those were at the core of what ultimately ended up in First Security moving over and being acquired by Wells. It was this sense that we wanted to keep that here. And it started with a number of things, but I think that's a component of it.
You know, Utah is fortunate to have two very strong banks. One was First Security, now Wells Fargo. The other is Zions. Mm-hmm. Which obviously is based here. Do you think if Zions had not been based here, that the decision to sell, for all the reasons you just articulated, would have been more difficult?
I think ultimately it may have been. One of the driving forces in that whole equation, if you go back in history, and we don't have probably time to go through all the different details, but was to try to retain that First Security name and to try and retain a great, strong presence here. And when it wasn't possible to retain the name, going with what at the time we felt was the strongest choice and where the values were most aligned with First Security, that was why Wells was approached and the merger occurred. And you know, it's been a good choice, and Wells is a very, very strong bank. It's conservative. It weathered the economic downturn better than any other company.
And here we are almost two decades from the time that First Security sold. Mm-hmm. And Wells Fargo is still one of the most respected banks in the country, considered to be one of the best run banks in the country as well.
Absolutely.
So you guys chose wisely, and it's a good thing too, for all the reasons you mentioned. It's important that we have a healthy, vibrant banking system, not just here in Utah, but throughout the country. Your father, let me go back to your great uncles in First Security. So Mariner and George basically started, George Eccles, started First Security. I wasn't able to find whether George had any children. It looked like he probably did not. But Mariner did. Mm-hmm. His eldest son ended up being a hotel executive, owned a hotel up in Ogden, also unfortunately died at a very young age in his early 40s. How did your father get into the fold from a family standpoint? And what was the decision on Mariner's son's side to say, you know, I don't want to get into the banking, I like the hotel side? Do you know the story there?
Well, I know from my father's perspective. So my dad was, he went to the University of Utah, skied for him. He had been on the U.S. team also, and that was his goal, you know, to make the Olympics and World Championships and do great things there. And they used to say about my dad, oh, that Eccles kid, he'll never amount to a hill of beans. But he was a hard worker, and he graduated from the University of Utah in business and then went back to Columbia, like his uncles, and to get a master's in finance. And he did that, and he was working there. And he really had an acumen for numbers and for kind of just details. But while he was there, George called him back to work in Boise, Idaho. And at the time, and Boise's a great town, that's where I was born, but at the time, Boise was a little bit sleepier than New York City. And when he was working,
still might be a tiny bit sleepier than
yes,
New York City.
You're exactly right. But he was working, you know, at a large bank there in New York, and was young and trying to cut his teeth on, you know, the intensity of a New York lifestyle. He was married, and he thought that's where he needed to be and where he wanted to be. And when he was asked to go back to Boise, that was not at the top of his places in the world to go at the time. But he went back there and was working in a branch, and really initially did not want to be there. But 10 years later, when he was called from Boise to come back down to Salt Lake to continue working in the bank and doing things after he had done a lot of things and kind of proved himself up in Boise, he didn't want to leave Boise. You know, all of his kids, he'd had all of his kids there, and just their good friends were there, and they loved it. But he did, and part of it was a sense of loyalty and sense of commitment and responsibility, and came back, and ultimately a number of things occurred, and he became the head of the bank. And that's kind of that whole process. And as far as on Mariner's side, I don't know all the decision-making on their family side, but they all did the things kind of that they gravitated towards, that they liked, and I think that's an important component of life as well.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. You know, First Security was really a cutting-edge bank. I was impressed as I did a little bit of background research. First Security was the first banking system in the United States to use computers, mm-hmm. and was one of the first banks to participate in the credit card industry, which is now a common part of everyday life. But you can imagine back in the day when they first came up with it, this idea that you would have a card and you'd get these mini loans with no approval, mm-hmm. or it was really groundbreaking, very innovative. Are there other big innovations that First Security did that maybe is less known?
Well, I think a lot of trajectory change occurred when the bank went through the 1980s. George had just passed away, and my father assumed the role, and we went into an economic downturn. And I think anybody that remembers the 80s knows how difficult that was from a real estate perspective, and therefore from a banking perspective. And so that was a situation where First Security really had to look internally and look closely at how it was doing business, and it forced it to evolve and to change and to make itself very lean and very effective and cutting edge.
Great. Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more with Spencer P. Eccles, a co-founder and managing director of the Signature Group. Welcome back to The Bottom Line on KCPW. I'm Doug Wells. Today we're speaking with Spencer Eccles, managing director of the Signature Group and former executive director of the Governor's Office of Economic Development, also known as GOED, for the state of Utah. So thank you for sharing some of that family history. As I do research, as I do for all our guests, I was just fascinated with the story.
Well, it's like we've mentioned before, we've discussed, it's a really interesting story for me, particularly because I'm part of the family. But I look at Utahns and I look at who we are and what we have, and I just really feel strongly that everybody has something fantastic about their history, and that is kind of what makes us who we are. And it's good to go back and take a look at it and learn from it and take the good lessons.
Yeah, I completely agree. As I was hearing you talk and mentioning that Scottish are known for being frugal, I didn't know that. My father's background is Scottish. I have by default then some Scottish in me as well, and my friends that know me well know that I'm fairly frugal, so it must be genetic. And my father was frugal as well, so I love that.
It's in your DNA.
It's in my DNA. Speaking of DNA, your father was a competitive skier, hoping to make the Olympics. I know when you were younger, skiing was a big part of your life, a competitive skier. Tell us that. Who did you ski for, and what was your event, and ultimately, how did you decide, okay, this chapter of my life it's time to turn the page and go on to other chapters?
Well, like a lot of young men, they want to be just like their dad, or better, probably want to be better. I'm fairly competitive that way, and My dad had been a great skier, and I loved skiing, and so I skied for Park City. I got in the racing program, and it wasn't until much later, after I had my own kids, that I found out that my mom was a total saint, not just from the standpoint that she took good care of me and raised me, but she drove me virtually every day from grade school through junior high until I was able to drive myself up to the ski resort, up to Park City from Salt Lake. I would get out of school, you know, half day, and I would go up and I would do homework on the way up, and I would ski, and she would drive back down, take care of my other three sisters, then she'd drive back up, pick me up, and, you know, I'd work on homework in between there. She'd help me, and it just was a huge family commitment. And I'm grateful for that, because it's really made me who I am. But I wanted to, at an early age, be as good as I could be. And part of the goals along those lines were to make the U.S. team and to make the Olympics. And I ended up skiing at Roland Hall, St. Mark's, for Romark Ski Academy in the very first 3 years that they were in existence. And then I skied a year for the University of Utah. And really was what I would say is very average. There was nothing spectacular about me, but I was committed to trying to achieve the goal. And so I took a year off of college to go after making the team. And I did really quite well. And they put me on a development squad, took me to Europe, the U.S. team did. And that was, I made it just close enough that I felt like, oh, I better take another year. It was that 1 year experiment that turned into 6 years. And over that period of time, I raced internationally, and I tried to make the team and never actually made it. I raced and competed against all those guys. I coached a season with the national team as well, with the speed guys, after I had finished. But, you know, that was a challenge. The one thing I would say, you asked the question about how did I make that decision to ultimately finish? And I used to ask my dad, you know, when will you know? And he said, you'll just know. And I was about 26 years of age in the summertime, and I just felt like it was time. It was time to move on.
You just knew.
Yeah, I just knew. So I went back to school, got my undergraduate degree in history, and coached, like I mentioned, for a season with the team. And then I ended up going to graduate school, got my MBA, and it's a part of my life, and it has driven a lot of the decisions, the way I look at things, and the way I work on things, and the way I set goals. And I just think sports are an incredible part, and everybody ought to be involved at some level in sports, whatever it may be, whether it's individual or team. It just teaches you a lot of things.
Yeah, I have two teenage daughters, and both are in group sports, and I just love the emails and the messages that her coaches send her. Those are the ones that I get to see.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it takes place on the court. But they're just great messages between her and her teammates, and it's hard at the age of 13, 14, 15 to get that experience outside of sports. So it's a great learning ground. And you know, it's funny how life works, because you did not have your Olympic moment on skis, mm-hmm. but you did get to participate very significantly in the Olympics in 1997. The Salt Lake Organizing Committee asked you if you would lead the efforts up at Snow Basin to prep that area for the downhill competition. Tell us about that experience.
That was manna from heaven. The only problem was I didn't really recognize it was manna from heaven initially. I had hoped, as I was in graduate school, to go try and work on either coast in financial services, maybe in mergers and acquisition or in something, and really have that experience that my dad, I mentioned earlier, that my dad had, where you want to go and you want to kind of prove yourself, you want to cut your teeth on really hard work and getting intense cycles. And so that was my focal point. And the Olympic job came from, was completely unexpected. And I was grateful for the opportunity. And as I thought about it, and as I conferred with some older friends and mentors, they helped me just by asking questions, you know, what would you be doing if you were working in New York? and what would you be doing if you were doing the Olympics? And it became very clear that that was an opportunity that I couldn't pass up. And you mentioned the Olympics. I had always dreamt of making the Olympics, and I just didn't know that I was going to make it running the competitions for the all the men's and women's speed events and all the Paralympic alpine events. And it was truly a great experience, and it was life-changing and it, never to be repeated in that kind of way.
Yeah, it's a very unique opportunity. But as you point out, you were a young man at the time, and your path is influenced by some of these early career choices. So mm-hmm. I can see where that would be a difficult choice. You know, I was struck as when I came across that nugget when I was doing a little research, and we have a friend in common, Ted McAleer, and he had shared with me that I didn't know ahead of time that you had done that role for the Olympics. I was struck that was in 1997, which is 5 years before the Olympics.
Yes.
Tremendous amount of prep. What was that job like in the early days, and then what was that like maybe in the 6 months prior to the Olympics?
So I used to say I was employee like somewhere around 42 or something, I think is what I remember. And I used to say that we're going from 0 to 120 overnight, if you can compare it to being in a car. And it was a sense that you had this couple billion-dollar budget, and you had a startup company, and yet you had to have all the components of a large, well-oiled organization, but yet you didn't have all of the pieces in place that usually take years for a company of that kind of a budget size to have. So, for example, in the early days, I was responsible for ensuring that the venue was all set up for some of the test events we were doing, and we had to do that early on. And that meant acquiring the safety equipment, which were netting around the field of play or around the course. And it was a sizable budget item. And it had to be there, and it had to be there early. We didn't have a purchasing department or anything. So I had to, you know, I work with a little bit with our legal department and had to write the RFP or the request for proposal, and then had to receive the proposals, had to screen them in some fashion that was objective. And that is something normally in a large organization with that kind of budget, you would hand that, you would say, I need A, and you would hand that off to the purchasing department.
Right.
And they would go out and they would run that whole process. We didn't have that initially. Now, we did get that by year probably three, which would be around 2000, you know. But at that point, a lot of the equipment that I needed had to have been purchased. And so that's one component. The other component, though, was you had these incredible people that were professionals and veterans in their own field, whether it was in telecom or in venue design and architects and development and logistics or transportation or food services. Pick it. We had about 42 different functions. And these people just wanted to be involved. And so we had this incredible team of people that came together with one singular focus. And that was probably the greatest lesson that I learned and the greatest thing that I enjoyed participating or being a part of, was that just having a singular focus in your job, where if you work for a company, you know, it may be just a job. You're just pulling a paycheck, and there's no real mission, there's no real culture, and there's no real team around that. And for me, anything that I've done or will do in the future will benefit from that experience, in that it's really important to build a team of great people and to make good people better. And I always say, if you have good people, you can do great things. And that's what we did during the Olympics. And so culture
sure
is really
did.
Well, and it's a showcase of the state. You know, Mitt Romney, when he went back to the IOC and said, hey, we're going to get, you know, these tens of thousands of volunteers, he was in essence laughed at. And we were oversubscribed on volunteers by magnitudes.
People didn't know Utah very well.
Yeah,
they didn't
know
think
Utah.
That was
number
was
one state for volunteerism, by
yes.
the way. So that's kind of the background on that.
You know, I had just moved to Utah before. Actually, it's 98 is when I moved to Utah. I thought I'd be here for 3 years, and here we are 2 decades later. Myself, I just fell in love with the state. I mean, there's very few places that you can live and and have an interesting career, and yet have balance in life and be so close to all these natural resources. So I was still getting to know the state when the Olympics were starting to take off. Do I remember correctly? There's now a major highway that goes to Snow Base, and it's wonderful. There was no highway back then, right? So that had to be built in preparation as well, and that takes a lot of preparation and time.
A lot of planning, a lot of time. There was some 25, 30 years worth of effort trying to get the Olympics here for the first time. The state had to step forward. The legislature, the governor at the time, had to step forward. We bonded for $52 million in order to build the jumps, somewhere in between, you know, the time that we made the first bid, the first real, probably what I would consider our focus bid when we lost out to Nagano, Japan. And the commitment there was that we were going to pay that back. And so a lot of preparation and a lot of commitment early on, knowing that there were risks associated with it, that we may not get the $52 million back. Well, all of that was paid back in full, and there was still a profit left over to fund the endowment, which now is the money that funds the Olympic jumping hill, the speed skate oval, the bob and luge track. And when I go up there and I see all of the young kids involved with sport because of that, because of the Olympics, and when I see, or you know, I've been to every Winter Olympics since then, and you see athletes that say, you know, I was inspired to become an Olympian because of what I saw in 2002 in Salt Lake City. And that is really great. And that's what the Olympic movement's really all about. And it's been phenomenal for our state.
Well, and I hope we get a chance to do it again sometime in the future. And hopefully it's in the fairly near future. If you're just joining us today, our guest is Spencer P. Eccles, Managing Director of the Cynosure Group and former Executive Director of the Governor's Office of Economic Development for the state of Utah. I want to move on to GOED, but before we go there, before we leave the Olympics, you know, there was all this preparation, 5 years. As I said, I was surprised that it was 5 years prior. It takes that much work. And then we're 5 months away from the Olympics, and 9/11 happens.
Mm-hmm.
How did your role, your job change given that new reality?
Well, the initial impact, obviously, was the tragedy and how saddened we were by what occurred, both in the loss of life and then just the complete change of trajectory for the country and for the families who were directly and indirectly impacted. So once that initial shock sunk in, there were a lot of questions. Should we continue to have the Olympics? Can we have the Olympics? What will it look like? The security budget went up immediately. And once it was determined that we would continue, that was... that became a major focus, and not just for the state and the Olympic Committee, but for the country. And so it became one of those watershed moments when the Olympics occurred and the flag from, you know, the Twin Towers came in. And everybody, I think initially, as I recall, expected that there would be an eruption and a cheer when that flag came in. And what happened was it just went deathly silent. And that was quite, it was unexpected. And it was just this reverent moment that brought the entire world and the entire country together. And so I think that really is the essence of how it impacted me, was that moment, seeing that moment, feeling that moment, and experiencing that with the entire world.
Yeah, it was an incredibly sad event. It's like many sad things that happen in our lives. I think in many ways it brought out the very best of America. Mm-hmm. And having the Olympics shortly after there, that was in hindsight a nice way for us to bond, not just with fellow Americans, but with the whole world.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So let's move on and talk about the Governor's Office of Economic Development, GOED. I'm familiar with GOED. I'm in the entrepreneurial ecosystem. I'm a big fan of what the state's doing here from an entrepreneurial perspective. And there's many prongs to building that ecosystem here in Utah. Tell folks what GOED does.
So the Governor's Office of Economic Development is really the tip of the spear for the state of Utah from a state perspective on looking at the economy and advising the governor on the economy and advising and the legislature, I would say also, and really working towards the best interest per the mission that and the mandate set out by both the governor's office when it was put underneath the governor's office and the legislature by virtue of the tools that were created and given to the office to really push forward economic growth for the state. And so that includes everything from rural economic development, which is a real challenge because every rural county has a unique set of circumstances.
The rural, but it's a very important component to our state.
Absolutely. And there are, you know, Carbon County is different than San Pete County. And the challenges are different, and the economic drivers for each of the areas are different. And so you have to be able to understand that and be sensitive to that and try to balance how to grow the economy in those areas while also focusing on areas like the urban centers, which are going to be the higher, where you're going to be able to get the higher numbers of jobs. And a couple of key things that Governor Herbert talked about, and he asked me to come run the office in 2009. It was in August when it was announced. And if you recall, August 2009, it was not really a cheery environment. And it was quite worrisome as a country, as a globe.
We were through the worst of it, but we didn't know it.
We had no idea. We were still looking back to the Great Depression and the lessons learned there and how shoe one dropped and then the shoe two dropped. And it was the shoe two that that dropped that really hit us hard back in the 30s. And so how did we approach that? And I always looked at it this way. Sometimes we manage our businesses for more than a generation in a conservative fashion to be prepared for something like that. And I think Utah had been managed that way. Prior governors, prior legislators or legislatures.
Utah's a very well-run state. I have a lot of respect. I moved here from California, and they have their strengths, no doubt about it. But Utah is an extremely well-run state. I don't know if it's still the case. I know for many years, we were the only state in the nation that had a AAA bond rating because we earned it. Other mm-hmm. states offer AAA bonds, but they buy insurance in order to be able to issue AAA bonds. State of Utah didn't have to do that, and I think we're still that way.
We are one of a very few number of states with AAA bond rating, and that's really mandated by the governor and by the legislature, and they're really careful about that. The governor makes an annual trip back to New York to meet with the rating agencies to go through that, and we get high marks. But you know, when we think about what GOED was doing in 2009, we had some tools to help grow the state, and we were in a situation where we didn't know which direction we were going. And the goal was to try and continue to ensure we had a healthy economic and vibrant economic environment. And Governor Herbert is oftentimes, people will hear him talk about, you know, let's keep government off your backs and out of your wallets. And so that means two things. One, we need to have a very friendly regulatory environment. And two, we need to ensure that we have a tax environment that's business friendly as well. We have responsibilities. There is a role of government to play. And so what is that role? And that's something that my team and I would ask ourselves every day. As the Governor's Office of Economic Development, what's our role and what are the tools that we've been given and what's our mandate per the legislature? And so we tried to manage that and to grow within that and recognizing the challenges and the, you know, exogenous impacts from outside of the state that we can't control. So what can we control? And so that's really what we looked at, and it had to do with helping ensure that we were trying to connect businesses with other businesses, connect businesses internationally with different governments or business opportunities in other places, work with the rural area, work with the outdoor recreation, work with education, and make sure that our workforce was well trained and that we were communicating the needs of business up in through the governor and to the legislature, and just ensuring that all the components that are associated with a healthy business environment, that those were in place. And not that we could necessarily impact all of those or direct those, nor should we probably in most cases, but that we could have influence on those and that we could at least be the guard, the guard on the tower saying, hey, we've got this issue we need to pay close attention to. And then also when companies were coming here to look, we worked very closely with the Economic Development Corporation of Utah, or EDC Utah, as a close partnership to help recruit companies here, to help them understand what's the education for K-12 and the higher ed, what's going on in the transportation system, what are all the tools that we have at our fingertips. And Utah is geographically positioned, economically positioned, legislatively positioned, and just culturally in terms of our conservative lifestyle position to be great. And you know, in the last 5-6 years, we've been number one state for business and careers on Forbes list. Four out of the last five out of the last six. I don't know where we are now, but
it's a great place for companies to be and to expand. Mm-hmm. It's also, you know, Utah competes with lots of other states for those companies and for that expansion.
Well, and not just other states, but other countries too.
It's a very good point.
So we are definitely in. This is what we tried to communicate through our mission statement and the four objectives that we laid out and that the governor put forward. Is that we are a global state, and sometimes I don't think it happens as often anymore, but there are times when we can feel being in Utah with only 3 million people, where some cities are bigger than our state in terms of population, we feel like we're just small Utah. We are not small Utah. We are recognized around the world as a great place to do business, and we are competing globally.
It's a great place to do business. It's also a state where if somebody's committed, if somebody has a passion, they can make a difference in this state. Mm-hmm. I look at your 5-year tenure at GoEd, a number of companies directly impacted and brought into the state. Over $5 billion of capital is committed to be deployed over a 10-year period. 30,000 new jobs from those positions. And over $2 billion a year in extra tax revenue for the state of Utah. That's just amazing. How big was your team at GoEd?
So we had about 72 people. And we're very lean even with that. Compared to other states, we're lean. And just with the workload, we always had an attitude that our constituency, which is every citizen, 2.9, now nearly 3 million people, every person is our constituency. So if they needed something, if they had a meeting, we would do everything we could to meet with them and understand what their needs are and what the situation was. We tried to structure things in a way to process things so that we could get the priorities to rise to the surface and really focus on those. But we also implemented a fellows program with / interns program where we would bring fellows in from universities and anybody else that was interested, it was available to all, where they would have an experience. And some of them were international and some of them were local. But the hope was is that somewhere down the road, if you're cycling 20 of these young men and women through the office, they're going to end up somewhere in a business.
I was at the GoEd office a couple weeks ago. One of entrepreneurs that I mentor was presenting. GoEd does these grants every year to foster entrepreneurship, and he was presenting for that. And he was a little nervous, and he asked me if I'd go with him. And that was my observation, was there were so many young people mm-hmm. Working there, which is just phenomenal to get that experience that early in their lives. And like I said, you know, Utah is a state where a young person can make a difference. You mentioned when you got the call about leading the group up at Snow Basin for the Olympics, that was an opportunity you were honored to be asked for, but you weren't sure that that was something that initially you wanted to do. When you got the call from the governor in 2009, was that a call you're like, yes, I'm really glad, or was that another difficult decision to make?
Initially, it wasn't necessarily anticipated. I didn't have any idea. I knew that Governor Huntsman was transitioning out to become the ambassador of China. I knew that Governor Herbert was taking over. And I got the call and I was like, okay, well, I've kind of got a full plate. I was involved with a number of venture companies that I sat on the boards of. And as you know from your entrepreneurial side, an early stage investment investor in an early stage investment oftentimes becomes unpaid labor for that in, that company in terms of mentoring and sitting on the boards, being involved. And
it's a lot of work to do it right.
It's a lot of work. And that's what I was involved with. And my schedule was really full. And I started thinking about it, though, and very quickly recognized that there's never a convenient time to give service. There's never a convenient time to give public service. And I felt like that was this is my time. I've been raised in a family where giving back is a part of who we are. We feel that we've been blessed, and we feel that we need to also return and to give back. And so, and I think we all have that responsibility. It doesn't matter what your circumstances are. We all have a responsibility to give back. And so, I took the opportunity, and I was grateful for it. And the Governor Herbert gave me a chance to do that. And frankly, I recruited a lot of people into the office under the auspices of there is never a convenient time to give public service. And I would try to get people to recognize that, you know, give me just a couple of years of your time. And we can't pay you what you can make in the private sector. And frankly, most people that work for us, we could never afford them with the wages that we were paying them compared to the private sector. And that's normal. But that being said, I just let people know that this will be a great period of your life. It'll give you an opportunity to see the entire state in a different light. It will give you an opportunity, as you pointed out, to make a difference. You can make a difference in this state, as you've indicated. And so that was a way that I was able to find some of the great people or retain some of the great talent that we had.
Well, you've recruited a couple of my friends, and they say you were very persuasive. It was not a job that they initially wanted to say yes to. And that's really important, surrounding yourself and being able to recruit that team. You know, one of the things that impressed me when I first came to Utah is the Utah Fund of Funds. Mm-hmm. I know you're on the board of that. The legislature passed the laws that allowed the Utah Fund of Funds to happen, but it took several years to get that going. It was actually a young, recent, I believe, University of Utah law student, Jeremy Nielsen, that took up the baton and said, we're going to do this. Mm-hmm. And you're in the back in the venture business, the private equity business. Tell our audience what the Utah Fund of Funds is and why at that point in Utah's history it was important to do something like that.
Sure. So it started before I got to the governor's office, and individuals like Paul Alstrom were involved with helping push that forward through Governor Leavitt. And it was at a period of time, it's hard to imagine today what it was like back in the 80s, but we were hemorrhaging our children in the sense that they were leaving the state for opportunity. It really was through the 70s and in the 80s, people felt like I need to leave the state to go get a good job. We did not have a lot of entrepreneurship in the sense that we think about it today going on. We've got Novell and WordPerfect that we can think back to in kind of iconically companies that were successful in a big scale and that stayed in Utah.
That's not many. Right?
Fast forward to today where you have, I mean, you can't list on two hands Utah startups that are now doing very well and a number of others that have had big exits. And I will tell you, I can assure you that we're going to have a lot of other companies that have started here and that will have big exits. And it used to be that a California VC would come here or venture capital firm would come here. They would find a good startup and they would invest in it, and they would lift it out of Utah and take it with them back to California. That doesn't happen anymore. They stay. And so the Fund of Funds really was established in a sense to help stimulate the entrepreneurial funding side of things, because you need a number of components, as you know, on entrepreneurship. You have to have a good idea, you have to have an entrepreneur that can push that through and good teams, but you have to have funding. And then another component of that, so that's the financial capital. You have to have human capital, people who have done it before, people that understand how to grow a business from, you know, two people in a garage to 1,000 people, to 10,000 people. And that doesn't just happen overnight. And so the Fund of Funds was established for that. And Jeremy did a phenomenal job getting it going and raising it. Now Brett Jepson runs that. And it's something that was helpful to help get some of these California venture capital firms to focus on Utah. I would say that a lot of that's happening now, just organically. When I stepped down from Go Ed, I stepped down from my role with the Fund of Funds, but I still stay close with Brett, and he's doing a great job.
Yeah, I know it's had some controversy, but I would say it's a perfect example of how the state can do something that nobody else can do, that can move the needle for the business. And it takes a state that's as business friendly as Utah to do something like that. I mean, ultimately, it's a long period, but it looks like it will not end up costing the state of Utah a dime to have done that. We'll probably get a return on our money for that. And it's just awesome that we live in a state that has the courage to do that, and just the capacity to be able to do it. Speaking of funds, your latest venture is the Cynosure Group. I love the full circle going back to the vessel that brought your great-grandfather, David Eccles, to the United States. Tell us about Cynosure.
Well, so, can you try that again?
It's okay.
Sorry. So, Cynosure, as you pointed out, is the name of the ship that brought David over, and it really helps us point back to our roots and where we came from and what made David and the businesses that he started great. And it speaks to a number of things. One, it takes a long time to build a great company. Sometimes it's a couple of generations. And it takes a lot of hard work. And the other thing about David was that he was very good at choosing partners, and maybe in some ways partners choosing him. Good people will gravitate together, and he was able to he had great partners. That's a key thing. The other thing is that as we've looked over the course of the last couple of decades at how the financial markets have evolved, and the types of investments that we've done as a family in private equity funds and venture capital funds and whatnot, we felt like we needed to do something a little bit different. And so this is a fund that's not a fund in the sense that we do direct investing. We don't charge on committed capital like a traditional fund. We charge on invested capital. The historical private equity, you know, leveraged buyout type, fund is really in many ways geared towards the institutional investor, and where typically on any given investment the average exit time is 5 to 7 years, and they're focused on a 5-year exit. Well, if you're looking to grow a great company and there's value still locked up in a company in year 5, because a lot of times these private equity firms are selling to other, sometimes strategics, meaning that they would sell to another company in the same sector as that company, but oftentimes to other private equity groups. If there's still value locked up in that company, why would you sell it? And when you sell a company, you have to recognize a tax on that. And why would you do that if you still have value and there's still opportunity? So as we've looked at this and as we've evaluated how to do things, that's the direction we're going, and we're trying to stay true to who David was and my grandfather and Mariner and George and my father, and look to build good companies and be a part of companies that are looking to continue to grow but would like to take some chips off the table, per se. and meaning they'd like to have monetized some of the sweat labor that they've put in, sweat equity they've built in a company. And so we invest with great management teams, and we are happy to take a minority share in the company and not do a traditional control buyout. And we're happy to hold on to it in some cases 20 to 100 years, or if there's an opportunity to exit, we're not afraid of doing that either. We don't have a mandate by virtue of having a fund that says you will invest this amount of money and you'll do it in the course of 10 years. That means we can pass on things that we don't think are good opportunities. We're not forced into it by virtue of trying to put money to work. And so that's kind of the base of that. And my business partners, Randy Quarles, who's also my brother-in-law, but had been Undersecretary of the Treasury under George W. Bush. He'd been in the Treasury for 6 years and then was 7 years with Carlyle. And they established from scratch a financial services buyout fund. It was an oversubscribed $1 billion fund, and he did well on the investing side. And then the other business partner is Bud Scruggs, who's an iconic figure here, and both on the political side, but also was, you know, 12 years with Leucadia and ran all their portfolio companies. And then, of course, we've got an incredible team in the office too. So those are some of the things that we're doing, and that's the background. And we're just moments away from launching a wealth advisory firm called Sinosure Advisors, and that will be coming here and to work with high net worth individuals and foundations and things, and hopefully help them grow their base so that they can continue giving back in the state.
Sounds extremely exciting. And like you said, you've got some wonderful partners in that business. You know, I was really surprised when I looked at your website, and you know, most multifamily offices would do, as we were talking earlier, funds as opposed to direct company investments. And I think the biggest reason for that is, frankly, it's a lot of work to invest in these direct companies. And as we've talked about your family's journey, there's ups and downs in all of these companies, and it takes involvement. It takes more than just dollars. It takes involvement. It takes work. How did you think about whether you wanted to be passive or active in your investing? Clearly, you came down on the side of being active.
Yeah, I think. We look at it as a partnership when we invest in a company. So it's active, but it's, if you're in a controlled buyout situation, you're going to get in and you're going to run the company. And, you know, the DNA of a company often is associated with the founder. And at some point, a founder may want to exit completely, but to come right in at the beginning and not really knowing all the details of a business other than, you know, what you learn over the course, a short period of time of due diligence, the approach we think that works well for us is to go that way. And again, I think a lot of it has to do with this idea that we should hold on to these companies longer than just 5 years, or at least have the flexibility to do that, and partner with great families or great founders or great companies to help them continue forward and hopefully expand and grow much in the way that companies did in the old days.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the phrase in the old days, because backing the founder is now back in vogue. You know, when I graduated Stanford Business School 2 decades ago now, there was this whole thought that you have the entrepreneur starts the company and then you bring in professional management. In fact, your investors would have the talk with you day one before they wrote the check. You know, there's going to be a time when the company outgrows you and we need to bring in professional management. And if you're not okay with that, we should not invest in your company. Those days are over. You know, We've now learned, you look at the really successful startup companies that have grown into something great, Steve Jobs, and there's, you know, an asterisk next to there. He left, he came back. Mm-hmm. Larry Ellison, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, the list goes on and on about the value of having the founder stay involved. There's something magical, there's something special about that initial commitment. I'm guessing that because of your family heritage, that's always been the Eccles family outlook, is we want the founder, we want the family involved in the business.
Well, I think the answer is yes on that. And it really comes down to, in our case, each situation is different and unique. But we want to help these companies in a way that's more than just financial, and we want to give them the opportunity to continue pursuing their dreams and growing their companies and adding value and adding jobs. And many of those will be in Utah, but there will also be throughout the Intermountain West and, frankly, across the country. We have investments that go as far as the East Coast. So we're looking at a lot. And also partnership is key. And I think that's really one of the key components of our family is partnering with people. And that's what David did. He partnered with great companies and great people and was involved in the details. And it worked out really well for him. And hopefully we can continue forward for the next 100 years and do something interesting there.
Well, Spencer, you've been very generous with your time with us this morning. Your family's been very generous with the state of Utah. Again, thank you very much for everything that you've done, your service to the state of Utah, as well as all the things that your family's done. First Security had a slogan, currently giving 110%, and it's clear that you and your family continue to do that, both in the business world as well as giving back to the state of Utah. So thank you very much for doing that.
Thanks, Doug. Appreciate it. It's been a nice opportunity.
Our guest this morning has been Spencer P. Eccles, Managing Director of the Cynosure Group and former Executive Director of the Governor's Office of Economic Development, GOED, for the state of Utah. Today's show was recorded at the KCPW studios on Library Square and produced by Ross Chambliss. Awesome job. Thanks for lining this up, Ross. It was a fun conversation. You're listening to The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week.